Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Friday, and we are very fortunate to be joined by my colleague Bill Kristol to talk about this amazing period of history that we're trying to survive. So good morning. Happy Friday, Bill.
And to you, Charlie. Good to be with you.
And congratulations on the new grandchild. It's a cool
thing. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And it's exciting. And so far, all is going well. So that's great.
All right. So let's talk about where we're at. I want to talk about the state of play in Ukraine also politically. I do think this is a very interesting moment for the Republican Party. Some real severe cognitive dissonance. And let's break that down. Before we do that, I want to talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger's video. And I'm going to confess that I've never been that much of an Arnold Schwarzenegger fan. I want to distinguish Arnold Schwarzenegger, the politician fan. But I was very impressed by this about 9-minute video he put out. I don't know where you come down on Arnold, Bill.
No, I think it's very impressive. I watched it like everyone, like I guess hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. God knows how many people in Ukraine watched it. And I hope people in Russia, it's an interesting question of how much they were able to get it into Russia. I talked with someone who's involved in efforts to do that, and they think they have some ability to get things online on the internet. They've pretty much shut down all the radio and TV stuff, yeah. Obviously. So anyway, it was an eloquent speech to the Russian people, and Schwarzenegger, I didn't know he had that Russia connection either. So
no, I didn't either. So I listened to it like the first three times. The first time I listened to it, you know, casually, sort of, you know, half listening to it, and thought, yeah, it was fine. Then I listened to it again, and I was a little bit skeptical. And then the third time I listened to it, and I thought, this is brilliant. because the thing that he does is he's very clearly addressing this to the Russian people, to Russian soldiers, to Russian mothers going through all of this. This is not aimed at an American audience. This is aimed at Russia. So he starts, let me just play a little bit of this. So Schwarzenegger first talks about how this pioneering bodybuilder named Yuri Vlasov inspired him when he was a teenager. And then he explains why he spent so much time talking about that particular connection.
Now, the reason why I'm telling you all of those things is that ever since I was 14 years old, I've had nothing but affections and respect for the people of Russia. The strength and the heart of the Russian people have always inspired me. That is why I hope that he will let me tell you the truth about the war in Ukraine and what is happening there. No one likes to hear something critical of the government. I understand that. But as a longtime friend of the Russian people, I hope that you will hear what I have to say. And may I remind you that I speak with the same heartfelt concern as I spoke to the American people when there was an attempted insurrection on January 6th last year, when a wild crowd was storming the U.S. Capitol, trying to overthrow our government. You see, there are moments like this that are so wrong, and then we have to speak up. And it's exactly the same with your government.
Okay, then he breaks down the lies, the propaganda, the carnage, and the violence, knowing that many Russian viewers or listeners of this might not have been told what actually is going on.
I know that the Russian people are not aware of such things are happening. So I urge the Russian people and the Russian soldiers in Ukraine to understand the propaganda and the disinformation that you're being told. I ask you to help me spread the truth. Let your fellow Russians know the human catastrophe that is happening in Ukraine. And to President Putin, I say, you started this war. You're leading this war. You can stop this war.
And he closes with this message to the Russian protesters.
Now, let me close with a message to all of the Russians who have been protesting on the streets against the invasion of Ukraine. The world has seen your bravery. We know that you have suffered the consequences of your courage. You have been arrested, you have been jailed, and you have been beaten. You are my new heroes. Mm-hmm. You have the strength of Yuri Petrovich Vlasov. You have the true heart of Russia. My dear Russian friends, may God bless you all.
So that is the message. And, you know, as you mentioned, but we don't know how widely viewed that was in Russia, but it was a pretty extraordinary message. And he has a kind of a unique ability, I think, to cut through some of all of this. Now, did you see that one report? Listen, I'm just passing this along because this is Twitter stuff, but it seemed credible to me that at one point Fiona Hill was pushing Schwarzenegger to be the ambassador to Russia because she thought that he might be able to communicate with the Russians and with Putin in a way that others couldn't. Have you ever heard that story? Is that true? Or am I just passing on some fake news?
I think it could well be true. When I first saw that video, I actually thought to myself, gee, you know, Biden could do worse than make Schwarzenegger special envoy to the Russian people or something like that and continue the messaging to the make clear that we're not opposed to Russia. We wish Russia well. We want Russia to come out of all of this nightmare of Putin and Putinism and move towards a free and prosperous future. So I don't think it was just an idea for the past. Maybe it's an idea for the present or the future. I mean, I just 2 points about it. I was talking to someone who's speaking to some people in Moscow and left there and, you know, speaks Russian, obviously. And she said that she thought, I said, look at these polls. It's discouraging, you know, all these people. I guess Putin's just succeeded in selling these lies. And we got into a discussion of disinformation and how difficult it is to break through once that complex of disinformation gets established in people's minds, and especially if you only have sporadic kind of ability to counteract it. That's true in the U.S. too, of course. And she said she thought it was a big generation gap. That, I mean, people who are 65, they're sort of, you know, they're used to Putin. Things haven't been that terrible under him. In fact, they've gotten somewhat better. They, for them, probably economically until the last three weeks. And that they, you know, that's very hard to penetrate. So when you see these polls, the 60-70% of Russians believe Putin. But she says that's not true of the younger generation. There's been enough interpenetration, enough travel back and forth, enough of a sense of what the rest of the world is like, including to Ukraine, incidentally, that you know, that they're less susceptible to the propaganda. So maybe Schwarzenegger can make a difference there. And I do think one thing we should all encourage the U.S. government, but also non-governmental agencies to do, is really make the effort to get this message, mm-hmm. these kinds of messages, into Russia. I mean, it's so important that, you know, it's weakened Putin's hold. It's not going to be a mass, you know, 100 million people turning against them, but the elites who are more likely to be watching some of this stuff and to be able to access things on their, you know, online and so forth, that very important for them to get a sense that there's a real future that's not a future with Putin. I think the other thing I'm struck by is we were talking about this before, you and I, Charlie, that, I mean, so Schwarzenegger was an actor. And,
yes, you know, it's extraordinary. Yeah.
A performer, as was Zelensky, as was Reagan for that matter.
Yeah.
And there is something about these crises when you really need to speak to people in a kind of direct way. And really it's not a matter of explaining a complicated policy, but it's a matter of good and evil, a matter of making a choice, a matter of standing up for freedom or dignity. Maybe these people like Schwarzenegger and Zelensky are better suited to do that than people who've been in politics for 20 years and have spent an awful lot of time triangulating among people's views and understanding or not understanding or the complexities of you know, some trade-off in domestic policy or whatever. And I this came home to me when I tweeted a couple of days ago, you know, we need to have, it's probably too late to get a Reagan Republican nominated in 2024. We need to have a Zelensky Democrat. I was thinking of obviously a successor to Biden who would have the spirit of Zelensky, you know, and both the substantive views in terms of being pretty hawkish, but also standing up for freedom in the world, but also the kind of ability he has to speak to people. And of course, people misunderstood it. And someone said to me, well, Zelensky can't run here in the U.S. You know, they took it too literally.
Literal.
But someone else I was chatting with, and I said, well, I don't know, some of these younger members of Congress, are they possible? They're pretty impressive, some of them, you know, some of the young Democrats. And he said, you know, maybe we should think more broadly. Maybe there really is someone in America who is not a politician, who's on TV or in the movies or, you know, who really would be sort of, in a way, a better candidate, not just a candidate, a better leader than our more conventional politicians.
Like who?
I don't know.
But see, this is the
John
thing.
John Stewart, one name that came to mind, though I don't think he's quite right for other reasons, but and he's a little older, you know, and maybe sort of last generation. But John Stewart did humiliate Tucker Carlson, remember that, on 15 years ago or something on television. And he then led that fight for, I don't remember the details, but compensating some of the victims and families of the victims of the 9/11 attacks. And he was testified to Congress. he has a little of that Zelensky streak of understanding. He's a funny guy, and a lot of it's all just irony and humor. But when he wants to make a point, he can make it.
Okay, now for people who are rolling their eyes at this,
yeah,
the notion of John Stewart as president is actually not crazier than the idea of Volodymyr Zelensky for president when he was a comedian and when he was on his own sitcom, when he was on Dancing with the Stars, when he was voicing Paddington Bear. So, I mean, this is interesting because in the abstract, the idea of more celebrities, more actors, actresses being in politics, I go, oh, boy, that's the last thing we need. But you're making an interesting point. Ronald Reagan, Schwarzenegger, and President Zelensky, you know, clearly show that the skill set is not irrelevant in terms of who is articulating this, who is able to inspire people. Because right now, look, I get accused of, you're going to bash Biden. Look, I mean, Biden is not FDR and he's not going to be Winston Churchill. So it is going to have to fall to other people to make these eloquent pleas. But again, on Zelensky, I had mentioned this on the podcast yesterday, so I apologize to people who think I'm repeating myself, but I do on a regular basis anyway. So, you know, get used to it. I have been watching The Servant of the People, which is the comedy series, actually rather political comedy series that Zelensky starred in Ukraine, began in 2015. And it is remarkable where he plays this school teacher who has this rant that is captured on video by one of his students and then goes viral. And somehow, miraculously, he's elected president of Ukraine. And so he's playing the president of Ukraine. And I said this to Michael Weiss yesterday. It was just surreal yesterday watching that a day after he spoke to the United States Congress, you know, what he has become. So he spent years on television playing the president and then became the president. So yeah, nothing is too strange. It's on Netflix.
I'll have to watch that. I mean, you mentioned FDR and, of course, Churchill. You know, they were, of course, spent a fair amount of time thinking about the performative aspects, as we tend to say pejoratively these days, but they would, there's a positive side to that, of their jobs, right, of being president or prime minister, especially in wartime, rallying people. Churchill's, you know, was he not only mobilized the English language and sent it to war, but there, the visual effect of, you know, walking around during the Blitz, is a little bit of De Gaulle, if you want to think. I mean, the best case, obviously, is to get someone with the experience and political wisdom of a Churchill or De Gaulle or FDR, for that matter, and the kind of, let's say, theatrical ability. But I agree. Normally, I'm slightly anti-theatrical for, you know, because it's,
right,
it can go in very bad directions, but especially in crisis, but also, of course, to counter a kind of theatricality of the other side. It's if it's in the service of freedom and of democracy, not in the service of you know, cult of personality, it's a good thing. And so anyway, I don't know that, I'm sure we're going to get like 5,000 emails to John Stewart. Yeah. Are you kidding me? But that's more the idea of that, of John Stewart, or maybe the idea of someone who is effective at speaking and can speak directly to the public these days and with new media and the like. So, but the Zelensky thing is worth reflecting on. I mean, just because look what a fantastic leader he's been. And I'm not sure that was predicted.
So no one could have imagined it. I don't think. So let's talk about the state of play in Ukraine right now. I will say, and I want to put an asterisk over it, that I'm not a military expert and I resist too much optimism about this. But in the last 24, 48 hours, we're getting more and more reports about the extent of the Russian losses in Ukraine. Michael Weiss mentioned this website called Oryx, O-R-Y-X, which is, you know, highly credible. And they tweeted out, Russia's losses are completely unsustainable. They're losing huge amounts of equipment and manpower while not even conducting major offensive. When the loitering munitions start arriving for the Ukrainians, these losses are only set to increase. Russia has already lost, just doesn't know it yet. So I guess the question is, you know, number one, do you agree with that? And number two, where do you come down on this question of, are we doing enough to support the Ukrainians?
So number one, I mean, wars are unpredictable and they're dynamic. And therefore, I always resist the kind of they've lost and don't know it yet thing, because that's sometimes true, obviously. But another time, look at Iraq, even we won. Then it turned out we hadn't really secured the victory because we didn't have enough troops and made some mistakes. Maybe it was unsecurable, some would argue. then we had the surge and we sort of won again. And, you know, so these things, I mean, that's a little over a longer time horizon, I grant, but these things could change quickly. A breakthrough, some new weapons used by the Russians, a tactical failure by the Ukrainians, who seem to have been extremely intelligent and clever so far, but, you know, you can't count on that at every moment. So I remain nervous, but heartened. I mean, certainly this is not what people, and I'm good people and serious people who've been through wars and been served and been generals for that matter. This is not what people predicted 3 weeks ago, which is a good lesson, incidentally, of the difficulty of predicting these things, but also heartening because generally if the Ukrainians have outperformed and the Russians have underperformed, one supposes that might continue. So, but I'm worried about Putin escalating. I think we've made too clear our fear of even seeming to do something escalatory. It's a word that I've noticed Biden, I believe, has used in his statements, at least, and Jen Psaki uses. And why are we even using it? Of course, we shouldn't be foolishly escalatory, but we need to be serious. And I think someone at this point at the Bulwark just yesterday, Eric Edelman, Ellie Cohen, someone on one of the podcasts, you know, we have ultimately escalation dominance if you really want to get into that game. And we have plenty of reasons to be able to intimidate them if it comes to it. We don't want to get to the levels of, you know, having to enforce a no-fly zone and so forth. So the best way to prevent escalation is to end the war quickly, to strengthen Ukraine as much as we can. So I come down sort of in between you and Will Salatin, I guess. I mean, I think some of the calls originally, no fly zone, were not thought through. Mm-hmm. But I would also say the reaction to that, the kind of slightly smug World War III, you don't know anything, you know, let me tell you, we got to be super careful. That was also too smug. And as a result, I think the administration has sort of slightly stumbled, maybe it's not fair, but made its way to a reasonable place. But I still think there's about, I'd be 10-20% more aggressive in terms of really making sure they get everything as fast as possible. And then really making clear to them, maybe it's better done privately, that's what I don't know, rather than publicly, making clear to them that any, you know, the attempt to stop weapons from getting in, the attempt to do anything beyond the borders of Ukraine, the attempt to escalate to chemical or biological or obviously nuclear weapons, that's just a whole different ballgame. And that will be met with very severe and regime-threatening responses by us and the like. So I would be, you know, I'm sort of, as I say, somewhat more worried that they haven't been quite as aggressive as fast as they should be, but they've mostly gotten certainly in the right direction, and they've gotten, I think, most of the way there. I think, honestly, the criticism, having criticized myself a little bit, the nature of the debate, a little oversimple, I think in general, the criticism has been good. That is to say, it's good for the Biden administration to feel pressure to do more, because then they do some more. It's sort of how our system tends to work. McCain and Dole pressure Clinton to do more in the Balkans, and he does eventually do more. You know, it's a little slower and a little later. And so I think we're in a pretty good place, but I worry about making clear to Putin the consequences of escalation. Now, he could decide to anyway, especially if he's desperate. So that we need to really be serious about. I assume the internal planning is happening, but I mean, that there are many different scenarios and different kinds of weapons and different kinds of things he could do. That also makes me a little nervous when people say, well, they've lost the war, they don't quite know it yet. Well, that could ultimately be true, but we could go through a lot of difficult times and moments and days and weeks before they really have lost, and they have a lot they could still do that would kill a lot of people, frankly.
Well, that's right.
So I'm you know, concerned, but sort of think we're in the right direction.
Yeah, no, the whole question of losing the war, what does defeat look like? I talked about this with General Mark Hertling last week, I think. And, you know, he made the point that you only end a war when one side is willing to admit it's been defeated. Otherwise, it can just drag on and be incredibly deadly. And the question is, can Vladimir Putin acknowledge that he has been defeated here? Because that's extremely difficult. I have two big questions.
Or can others in the leadership acknowledge it and say, time for you to go,
exactly.
Or not even say anything, just do it. You know, that I hope we're doing a lot behind the scenes in that respect. And it's going to mean, look, us swallowing some things we don't want to swallow, people who are in effect have been complicit in Putin's war crimes. We're going to have to tell them probably, look, if you take them out privately, if you take them out, we'll work with you. You know, you hate to give any of these people any kind of out, but obviously it would be important to do that if it ended the war and caused them to withdraw.
Well, and we are getting reports of kind of a crack up at the Kremlin, where you have people who have been detained, generals who have been fired, two FSB generals are under house arrest. The National Guard, head of the National Guard, was forced to fire his deputy. So, I mean, things are going on here. There's a little bit of paranoia right now in the Kremlin. But these two questions that I have, and I, this is not a new one, which is the bright line that has been drawn between giving the Ukrainians jets, because that would be escalatory. But then, so therefore, we're not going to do that, but we're going to give them these really lethal drones and these other weapons that will also, you know, knock Russian planes out of the sky. I mean, I understand, you know, some of the distinctions here, but it does seem that people have, assuming if we had Ukrainian pilots flying MiGs and they shot down a Russian plane, that would be unacceptable. That would be World War III. But if we have a Turkish drone that is killing Russian tanks, or we have these S-300 anti-aircraft weapons that also knock out high-altitude planes, that's not the same kind of escalatory. I'm not sure. And my second question is, what is going to happen with this, this talk now that Slovakia wants to give the Ukrainians these very, very powerful anti-aircraft weapons? Is this going to play out the same way that the Polish offer to give them the MiGs? Will we greenlight this? Will we figure out how to work this? Because that seems to me to be the best option. And again, I'm not a military expert. I'm just pretending to be on a podcast. That seems to be the best. If you're not going to have a no-fly zone and you're not going to give them the MiGs, give them the weapons to at least knock some of these planes out of the sky and maybe some of the cruise missiles.
I totally agree. I mean, the handling of the MiGs was the kind of worst point, I would say, in terms of the administration's. I don't know if the decision itself may have been defensible, that it wasn't worth going to the trouble to get them a rather small number of MiGs that wouldn't make much of a difference. But then just quietly say, look, we're doing other things. This is not quite the military priority, I think, that the Ukrainians think it is. And don't get into all this rhetoric about it would be escalatory, because that is both stupid. I mean, as you pointed out, it's ridiculous. It's no more escalatory than in fact, it's probably less escalatory, to be honest, than advanced anti-aircraft missiles. But also, it just gives Putin that kind of veto ahead of time. Now, people have made a little too much of that, too. I mean, you can make a foolish statement one day. It doesn't mean we've totally ceded ground to Putin and we're just not responding at all. I would say also, incidentally, on the kind of terror he's now perpetuating, the bombing of civilians and stuff, I do not think it's wise to rule out that we would say, look, we're not going to try to enforce a no-fly zone over Ukraine, for one thing. It's extremely difficult to do massively. But if we know that particular planes or particular missile sites are being used purely to target civilians at this point and to kill people, we do not rule out taking those out. And by we, I mean we, maybe the U.S., maybe NATO, maybe material, weapons that we would provide to Ukrainians. But I have no problem as a matter of morality and of even general politics of taking out sites that are being used to slaughter civilians, of taking out planes, taking out missiles themselves in the air or the missile sites. Now, if the missile sites are in Russia, you get to a different level of decision as opposed to if they're in Ukraine. And if maybe there's a difference between U.S. planes at that point and NATO planes. But these are all practical considerations that are important to think through. But the idea that there's a red line between one or the other, and the idea that we're just kind of can't do anything if it's missiles that are being launched by Russians, and if the Ukrainians can't take care of it, we're going to watch, huge numbers of Ukrainian civilians be targeted and killed, not killed incidentally, not killed sort of accidentally, not killed even by Russian just carelessness. They don't care much about civilian casualties, but literally targeting them. So I'm think there we should be more, at least I hope we're privately at least looking at what we could do. And I think at some point a public threat, if we're willing to follow through, of course, to Putin to say, look, there's a war going on. We think it's, of course, a totally unjust war in the first place, and the whole war is, in a sense, a war crime. But these crimes, we're not going to watch this happen for another, days or weeks. But anyway, that's where I think the Biden administration's rhetoric has been somewhat off. Otherwise, been pretty good in many ways. But here, I think the sort of strict distinction between NATO and Ukraine, the strict distinction between U.S. and NATO arms and Ukrainian arms, is both unrealistic and at some point morally problematic.
So let's talk about rather unusual political moment we're in right now, where we have a bipartisan consensus that we ought to do more for Ukraine. In fact, Republicans right now are more likely than Democrats to say the United States is providing Ukraine with not enough support. These numbers are very interesting. I'm looking at the Pew numbers. So only 7% of Americans overall think that we are doing too much for Ukraine. only 9% of Republicans or lean Republican voters. When you break it down to conservatives, only 9% of conservatives say that we are doing too much for Ukraine, which does raise the question, like, who speaks for the Republican Party right now? Okay, so we have a vote in the House of Representatives to cut Belarus and Russia's most favored nation trade status. Only 8 Republicans vote against that. I mean, that's 8 Republicans. You know, many of them are prominent MAGA types. You now have more than 24 Senate Republicans demanding that Biden do more to aid Ukraine, even though many of them voted against the $13 billion in military and humanitarian assistance for Ukraine. So we're getting a little bit of cognitive dissonance, aren't we? The base is going one way. Elected Republicans are going one way, pro-Ukraine. And yet you have this very, very vocal pro-Putin or anti-Putin wing of MAGA world led by people very close to Donald Trump who are going in the opposite direction. So talk to me a little bit about this politics, because this does strike me as something different than what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years.
I think I think it's different. I've always thought that being pro-Putin could be a bridge too far or a bridge further too far than being pro-January 6th or being pro, you know, using the Defense Department and Justice Department in ways that are antithetical to the rule of law or pro a million other things that that Trump was as president. I've always thought possibly that would be the case. And of course, enough Republicans now seem to think that's the case, that they're busy scurrying back to look at least vaguely, you know, to distance themselves from Putin and from those Republicans who are being pro-Putin. So the Minnesota Republican Party, which in other respects seems totally crazy and pro-big lie and pro-every terrible thing that Trump has been for, disinvited J.D. Vance, who's been one of the most explicit Putin apologists and Ukraine sort of who cares about Ukraine.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or another, he said. And that has not aged well for him.
Right, right. No, that's not welcome, even in the Minnesota Republican Party. So I think that's interesting. They clearly think it's a vulnerability. Now, is it a vulnerability they can just slough off and pretend they didn't have the position they had and didn't support a president who had the position he had for the last 4 years and then for the next year as well? And can they pretend there's no relationship between being pro-Trump and pro-Putin? That was not a bug of like Trumpism. That was a feature of Trumpism. And I think it's important for those of us who are critics of Trump and Trumpism to really make that point and not let them get away with a kind of easy criticism. I said, I think on Twitter, that it reminds me a little bit. It's like the communists at some point, Stalin became indefensible. But a lot of people then just said, well, Stalin, that was kind of crazy. It was really excesses, so we don't approve of all that. But the communist experiment in the Soviet Union remains a noble experiment and progress. And of course, we have to still be on board. Or Lenin was fine. Stalin wasn't, right? Remember all that stuff?
Right.
I think we're in a little bit of that stage. And look, at the end of the day, the criticism of Stalin did open the gates for some people to leave the whole movement, if you will, or the criticism of Hungary in 56. You know, there's a kind of a wedge that gets put in there. Once you acknowledge they do one thing wrong, they were wrong about one bigish thing, then it's easier to say, well, they're also wrong about this. Or it lets them just kind of dodge and, you know, and kind of go back to where they were. And I think that's a challenge for us, the people like us, to make this point and bring it home. And as you say, it's an interesting question of where the voters end up, but it's somehow a bigger deal. It's so, I mean, what Putin is doing is does seem different in kind or in scale from what, you know, all the things, ultimately what Trump did and here at home is really dangerous and terrible, but not as visible, obviously, as what Putin did.
Well, that's right. It's not on television in the way. So, I mean, look, we've been through this before, this time for choosing this, you know, the fight for the soul of the Republican Party. But this one is a little bit clear, and it's not about Trump's mean tweets or about his personality. It's about the question of, you know, are Republicans going to continue to back their party's most open Putin defender? What is their vision of America's role in the world? So this is, and they think that in terms of preventing Trump, you know, as part of the never again Trump, this is the moment, I think, to continue to drill down on, this is what this guy did. This is what he said. The Republicans would sort of want to segue past all of that and go to Biden and Biden's weaknesses and everything. And fine, they can do that. But I don't think that we should let this particular moment pass because this strikes me as a moment of maximum vulnerability. There have been some moments of maximum vulnerability in the past that have slipped away, including January 6th and the aftermath on January 7th. But this, I do think, is different because I can't recall a time when the MAGA world was more out of touch with their base. Now, listen, I have predicted, because I'm so cynical, I guess, and I wrote in Politico about this, that even though the, you know, Putin is, you know, a genius wing of the party, is tiny at the moment, the MAGA voices are still the Republican id, and they still have a significant foothold in the entertainment wing of the Republican Party, and the entertainment wing of the Republican Party is still, or has been, the dominant wing of the Republican Party. So my prediction was that Republican politicians would sooner or later fall in line, but I might be wrong there. I admitted in my newsletter that I might be wrong. This actually might be different. So bookmark this as a moment, because I thought Dave Weigel had a very interesting point. He said, you know, Republicans like Liz Cheney, increasingly marginalized in the party before the Ukraine crisis, have new math on their side, where suddenly it's people like Liz Cheney who have strong majorities behind them, and people like Donald Trump and Steve Bannon who are speaking to what, you know, 5 to 10% of the Republican base. So this is a moment.
But I think your caution is also well-advised in the sense that, you know, are we at January 7th and everyone suddenly is sort of not willing to stand with Trump, but 3 weeks later, but A, they don't denounce him, they don't vote to impeach him or to convict him. And then a month, 2 months, 3 months later, they're back on board with a slightly sort of under their breath muttered, well, of course, I don't approve of that stuff. And then, of course, 3 months after that, they do approve of that stuff, even in terms of January 6th. I don't think we'll quite get to the approving of that. I think a lot depends on what happens, though. I mean, January 6th, I mean, thank God Trump left office 2 weeks later. And in a funny way, there was no actual ongoing thing to continue to hold his feet to the fire. I mean, God knows, we all tried to, of course, and we all
he was gone. Turn the page, let it go. Yeah, move on.
But I mean, there's no actual like news each day that except for some revelations of what had happened before January 6th and then during January 6th. This is a very different situation. But I think for me, the question is right now, Republicans are not going mostly in the MAGA, in the full MAGA pro-Putin route. They're not, on the other hand, denouncing exactly everyone. There's a couple of, as we said, disinvitations to J.D. Vance, but that's pretty tame. I think one guy is running an ad I saw again in a Senate primary, I think it is, against the other for being pro-Putin. If that happens more and more, I'll start to believe it. That means their consultants and their polling presumably is showing that it might be a vulnerability. If that's a one-off, and if a week from now they're all back to the same rhetoric and just ignoring the Putin question. And Liz Cheney, I mean, you raised the key point there. Well, will anyone say Liz Cheney was right? Will anyone say, you know what, you people in Wyoming, you Republicans, you should renominate Liz Cheney? Now, that I have not seen yet. You know what I mean? No. So I think your caution that I think there's an in-between position between they're all going to be totally pro-Putin in 6 months. That would be the worst case. Or they're all going to be, or Trump, and Trump is still going to be paying a huge price for Putin in 6 months. And the in-between position, which is certainly what Kevin McCarthy and people like that are going to try to get to, is a kind of quiet about it, but not actually rethinking anything fundamental.
Well, and the revisionist history that we've seen before, don't underestimate their ability to do that. So what they will do is they will retcon Trump and Putin into, you know, no, Trump was really strong on Putin. He was actually much more aggressive. You already see this happening. The whole party line that Putin never would have invaded while Trump was president. He was the strong man.
Right.
You know that they will try to do this.
And also, I mean, Biden will make some tactical error or something, or, you know, or screw up, or, you know, just to, as he did with the escalatory thing. In the next weeks and months, undoubtedly, and they'll jump on that and pretend that that, you know, that'll become the issue, right? And that they can all denounce and they'll forget about Trump's 5 years, you know?
Yeah, and they'll pivot to Hunter's laptop. So you mentioned the Senate primary. I mean, in Ohio, this has become a big issue in their Senate primary. In North Carolina, you also have this, the former governor, Pat McCrory, is now running ads accusing the Trump-backed his Trump-backed opponent, Congressman Ted Budd, of praising Putin's intelligence while Ukrainians bled and died and attacked him for voting against previous round of sanctions against Russia. And the Club for Growth is trying to defend Budd. I don't know how they become so super Trumpy, whatever. You always have to follow the money sometimes with these groups. They're running ads saying, no, Congressman Budd was really strong on Putin. So this has become really a flashpoint in this Senate primary, which is very interesting. I also saw Senator Tom Tillis, Republican senator from North Carolina, tweeting out kind of an attack on fellow Republican Madison Cawthorn for becoming a fixture on Russian state television propaganda. So you really do see this becoming an issue within the Republican Party. Now, whether or not they will actually connect all the dots and say, okay, if we are going to take this position, we absolutely cannot put Donald Trump back in the White House. This is the problem. And I keep looking for it. You have this strong majority pro-Ukraine, but not one elected Republican or prominent Republican that I've seen has said, okay, you know, this is the issue that I'm breaking with Donald Trump on. This is the moment where we recognize we can't have four more years of somebody who might dismantle or undermine NATO and who clearly is a sycophantic suck up to Vladimir Putin.
No, I think you're right. And that's the thing to watch for. Will anyone go to the Kinzinger, you know, at all, Cheney point of view that we can't have another 4 years of Trump? Will anyone endorse Cheney? I'd say is the second question. And I do think North Carolina, but I've probably focused a little more on my own just observing of Republican primaries on Pennsylvania and Ohio. But actually North Carolina, I think has the kind of simplicity of Budd, who's a congressman after all, so he's not a nobody, endorsed by Trump. McCrory, who's a former governor, I think before that mayor of Charlotte, endorsed by the kind of business establishment types. Tillis basically weighing in on McCrory's side, I think it's fair to say. And he's a senator from North Carolina. But then there's also Madison Cawthorn, who's a member of Congress from North Carolina. So I think it is maybe North Carolina becomes, and I think their primary maybe is not too late in the season either. So that could become a real moment. And it's a state that has, incidentally, a kind of mixed Republican Party, an awful lot of MAGA supporters, but a big business establishment, obviously, in Charlotte and to some degree in, you know, the Raleigh, Chapel Hill area. So I do think it would be interesting to see if what happens in North Carolina. That may become one of the more indicative primaries. So some of this will play out now politically, not just in, you know, talking heads and, you know, who's, you know, saying what, but also in actual votes in primaries.
Well, exactly. And, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene has been deplorable from the beginning. And I'm sorry, you know, bring that back up again. But she has gone full pro-Putin. And what is going to be interesting to me is to see whether or not she continues to be enthusiastically embraced by other Republicans, like, for example, J.D. Vance, who made a big deal of it. Now, I think he's being killed by this particular issue. But Marjorie Taylor Greene is not simply, say, skeptical of, I mean, there's a sweet spot here, right, Bill? I mean, the sweet spot for Republicans is to be critical of Biden because he's not doing enough, or critical of Biden because he's too weak or whatever. But Marjorie Taylor Greene has gone full pro-Putin, and she and Madison Cawthorn actually attacking Zelensky, attacking Ukraine, using, you know, raw Russian propaganda about biolabs, disinformation, raw Russian propaganda about Nazis in Ukraine. And that seems to me to be, them testing the limits. How far can they go without breaking this silo that they have dominated for so long? And I think that's going to be interesting. I mean, look, do you have any... There's zero chance Kevin McCarthy is going to push back on them, right? I mean, we've been here before.
I mean, they have primary challengers. I think everyone's assumed it's a noble but, you know, sort of slightly hopeless effort in those districts. Maybe it'll be less so. I think the primary challenger, especially to Marjorie Taylor Greene, is someone who's raised some money and may even have local office. I can't remember. And so, doesn't sound like you and me. She's sort of, I'm loyal to Donald Trump too, but I'm not crazy like Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think that's probably the best we're going to do in those districts. But so, yeah, and I do think it's interesting to see there's a wide spectrum of where we could end up. I'm afraid that most of that spectrum, the most likely parts of that spectrum, remain, you know, how should I put it? Trump, certainly Trump acquiescent, maybe Trump enthusiastic, and sort of trying as much as possible to deflect issues, the question of Putin, and to blame Biden and the like, not a coming to grips with what has happened. But, you know, again, some people coming to grips, the Tillis comments about Cawthorn, maybe that's a little bit of an opening wedge. But again, we've also wished for opening wedges in the past and thought, I'm old enough to remember the first impeachment, which was over Ukraine, let me just remind everyone. And you made the point last week, I think a very good point, that that thing seemed to have gone down the memory hole, of course, after the drama of January 6th and the second impeachment, but it's sort of come back in a way, and the significance of it is now front and center for people. And I was involved in my sort of Defending Democracy Together hat, and I was still talking to more Republicans then. So I talked to, I don't know, a dozen Republican members of Congress who I had, you know, relationships with, who were decent people. Some of them retiring, to say, hey, why don't you vote for impeachment, or at least think about it, or at least would you take a meeting and, you know, hear the case for it from a, you know, constitutional scholar. And they were polite, mostly, and none of them, of course, voted for it, and only Mitt Romney voted to convict in the Senate. So I'm a little worried that this is the moment where they're being polite and saying, yeah, I want to listen to it. I'm very concerned. It's really terrible what they did. Can you believe that, Bill? I mean, geez. But, you know, on the other hand, I don't know, impeachment's a pretty serious thing. And I had that conversation with, and they were all kind of private, so I won't say names, but, you know, with sober, mm-hmm. serious senior members of Congress, mostly senior, and they ended up going along. And so that, unfortunately, could be the outcome here, but maybe not. Maybe Putin and war crimes is just a bridge too far.
Yeah, but you know, you said you're old enough to remember the first impeachment. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Donald Trump mocked John McCain for being a POW, yeah. and we're all thinking that's it, that's yep. the breaking point. So yeah. we have been here before. Although I just think the stakes have been raised so exponentially. Also. You know, it was an easy shot for Donald Trump to make, to say, you know, NATO is, why are we supporting NATO? Why does it cost so much money? What is this all about? And yet watching NATO right now, they're reminding us what it's all about. And so I think it's a little bit harder for the America Firsters and the National Conservatives to make their point that we don't have any investment in any of that, and that they don't deserve our support. So, you know, again, the stakes of 2024 rise all the time. For people who say, well, why are you still talking about Donald Trump? Because Donald Trump might become the president of the United States. And think about that in context. I actually mean this seriously. It comes off as snarky in my newsletter. I know that. But I said, my thought for today is, you know, we're faced with an unstable, paranoid autocrat who's consumed by delusions, dependent on lies and conspiracy theories, refusing to admit that he's been defeated, with his finger on the nuclear button. But thank God, we only have one, not two of them. Can you imagine?
No, I sort of laughed when I read that. I sort of laughed when I read that in your newsletter, but it was not so much of a laugh as a kind of, yeah, that is really, really true. I do think, look, it's worth getting back to basics sometimes. Not for me, I had a couple of conversations the last 2-3 days about what the Defending Democracy Group should do and so forth, you know, politically. And we're obviously doing a bunch of things on both sides of the aisle and all. But at the end of the day, it's kind of simple. Donald Trump, we should do everything we can to stop Donald Trump from being president of the United States, becoming president of the United States again. And that means, to the degree we can weaken him over the next year and a half, in general, that's a good thing. To the degree he can be weakened as a possible Republican nominee, that's a good thing. To the degree other people, whom we probably would find unpalatable too, but still can fragment the Trump support and can make it a very competitive race and maybe defeat him, or he decides not to run on the Republican side, that's a good thing. And then if he's the Republican nominee, hopefully enough people have voted against him in the primary that some of them defect, and that the case has been made among swing voters, and some Trump supporters have become disillusioned, so he loses the general. So it's a multi-stage. But I agree. I mean, keeping one's eye on that prize, so to speak, of saving democracy from a second term of Trump, saving America from a second term of Trump, is really, really important. And people can make different tactical decisions in the course of what issues work best against them, what to do in an intra-Republican way, what to do in an intra-conservative way, what to do in terms of working on the Democratic side to get the Zelensky candidate and not the weakest, not the Hillary Clinton candidate, not to be mean to Hillary Clinton, but since she lost to Trump, I'll just make it in those terms. There are many things to be done, but keeping one's eye on that goal is very important, I think. And then, of course, defeating Trumpism more broadly and strengthening our democracy. And yeah, that's all important, too. I don't mean to minimize any of that. But first things first.
Let's end on that note. I think that's a good note to end. Bill, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Have a great week.
Thanks, Charlie. And the podcast has just been terrific the last few weeks in the heat of this, really enlightening in terms of all kinds of guests in the heat of this crisis. So
thank you. And we're going to try to keep that up. So thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.